It's time for No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Government's Area Agency on Aging. Here are your hosts, Murphy Houston and Jayla Sanchez-Warren from the Area Agency on Aging.
It's time for No Copay Radio. Well, it's Sunday morning. It's Cozy 101.1. It's about 7:30, so it's No Copay Radio. Brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Government's Area Agency on Aging, 303-480-6700. I am Murphy Houston, and my partner, Jayla Sanchez-Warren, who runs the Area Agency on Aging, is here. Jayla, all is well?
All is well.
Good, good. And guess who's back with us? We haven't talked to this guy in a long time. I just thought he dumped us like a bad habit. Dr. John Douglas, former director of Tri-County Health, also worked with the CDC, and he's been with us on No Copay Radio. How many years, John? Three, four now since COVID started?
It's our whole lives, isn't it, Murph? No, I think it's more than that.
Wow, what a shot. It's our whole life. And speaking of that COVID thing, Jayla, you got an idea for the first edition here of No Copay Radio?
Yeah. You know, we got an email from the federal government saying, hey, there's an uptick in COVID, and AAAs, you should be prepared for this. And then they also said there's going to be a new vaccine, hopefully coming out in October, and that we should do outreach to homebound folks and prepare to do transportation to help people get vaccines in the fall. So what do you know about the new uptick in the new variants of the virus?
Well, we are certainly hearing reports of that from across the country. And we've also seen a slight uptick in Colorado as well. I need to remind everybody that we don't really monitor cases like we used to because there's so little testing going on and so few people are actually reporting testing if they use home tests. So counting cases like we used to just isn't a good guide. What we use instead are hospital rates because we think that's pretty reliable. If you're sick enough to need a hospital and you get tested, we think that's probably being consistently done. And also wastewater sampling, meaning you can actually find COVID particles pretty reliably in sewage because we poop it out, honestly, when we get sick. So we're using those two surveillance mechanisms. In Colorado, we've seen about a 10% increase in hospitalizations over the last couple of weeks. This mirrors the national trends where we've been seeing this happen as well. And it appears to be due to two new variants. One is called EG5, which has got a number of mutations that theoretically should make it more, even more transmissible, a little bit like Omicron was worse than what we'd been experiencing before it came along. And another one, I mean, we shouldn't really be focused on these numbers because they're, or these names because they're so complicated, but it's BA286. And both of these together look like they're somewhat protected by prior vaccination, but not completely protected. And they're likely going to be creating some sort of bump. I hope it's only a bump, but some sort of bump in the weeks and months to come.
Wow, that's something to think about. So what are they going to do, John? Another vaccine coming out that we'll have to get taken care of?
Well, the vaccine that we're going to be, hopefully, as Jayla said, getting end of September, early October, is one that was based on the variant that was circulating last spring. That's always what's been done for flu because it takes a while to develop the new vaccines. RNA vaccines can be developed more rapidly. That's good. And the vaccine was chosen in June. There's pretty good coverage, we think, between that vaccine and these new types circulating, but it's not a perfect fit. But, yeah, we all really ought to be focusing, paying attention to when the new booster is going to be released, and especially if we're in an at-risk group, older folks, people with immunocompromising conditions, heart and lung disease ought to definitely get that booster.
Wow, Jayla, you're going to be busy.
Yeah, you know, we're starting to encourage people who are at risk to wear masks. I want to remind folks that we have tests at the Area Agency on Aging, that we are a regional test site, so we can send out tests or deliver tests So that is important to know. We also have we're thinking about, should we start ordering masks again? My staff are, I've been counseling them. If you're going to a large group, if you're going to someone who's particularly frail, you start testing. So, back staff are testing. My husband flew on a plane recently, and he said, I had a mask with me, and I got on, and I wasn't wearing a mask, but several people had one on. He's like, I wasn't sure what was going on, but I'm putting mine on if they're putting their on.
Wow.
One.
Good
like,
thinking.
I don't know what's happening here, but I'm putting my mask on.
Well, I don't know about you guys, and John, you too. It's been a long time since I've seen somebody wearing a mask. How about you?
You know, I see it periodically. I was on jury duty yesterday. I didn't get selected, but I had to go down and sit. And I'd say maybe out of 200 people waiting, two or three were wearing masks. So not many. But, there's still people who I think likely have either personal health issues that make them a greater risk, or they may be living with someone who's got those sort of health conditions. I'm guessing, honestly, that we'll see them come back. Not everybody by any means, but I think as we begin to hear more and more, oh yeah, my neighbor got COVID. Oh yeah, my neighbor couldn't go to this wedding because she got COVID. I think more and more of us may be reminded of the value of mask wearing.
I think, well, that involves your kids too, don't you think? I mean, it's kids that are in school already. What are we going to do? Start wearing them back to school this quickly?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely they'll be used in schools. I mean, there was such a scar tissue left in terms of kids wearing masks in schools, although there will clearly be parents whose kids themselves have got serious health conditions who may choose to do that, and there probably will be some teachers as well. My guess is that mask wearing in schools is going to look like mask wearing in movie theaters or airports or jury duty.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Right.
Are there going to be some people choosing to do so and some people not? Likewise in churches. I still have people in my church who wear masks, but it's probably, no more than 5% or so.
And that's the choice, right? I mean, and I'm glad people are aware, and that's why we talk about it. It's just be aware that this virus is out there, that it's mutated, because that's what viruses do. That's like their whole job is to mutate so they can stay alive, right? And so we have a couple new mutations. Be aware of that. If you want to wear a mask. If you don't, you don't, right?
Pretty well said right there. That's for sure. And, John, I'm asking, and if you know, are the treatments now from the way we handled COVID initially years ago to what we might be seeing coming up now, and hopefully nothing much, but when they go to the doctor or when they go to maybe a hospital even, is the way they handle it, the COVID case coming to them, is it the same?
Yeah, the treatments have actually stayed pretty similar. One of the big questions with any treatments is whether new variants, new mutations will develop resistance. We've seen that with bacteria and drugs for decades now. We've seen a little bit of antiviral resistance to develop to antiviral drugs. That's happened with flu. So far, it has not happened with COVID in the pills. So Paxlovid, one Murph that you and I personally had experience with last year, that one still works just fine as far as we can tell. But the monoclonal antibody infusions that we used during COVID, those really haven't kept up with the time. So some of the drugs won't work. Things like Paxlovid, the pills, do work. One thing I wanted to point out and remind everybody is that we don't know if we're going to have bad respiratory virus seasons with other respiratory viruses. But, last year we had that triple epidemic with flu and RSV.
Right.
And we've had flu vaccines. They're not perfect, but they work pretty well for many, many decades. We now have an RSV vaccine that's especially recommended for folks 60 years of age and older. So that's something really worth being attentive to. It's in the drugstores now, as are the flu vaccines. And I think, Jayla, it's probably useful to get out the advice really about all three vaccines. I'm sure you're thinking about that. But certainly,
we definitely are. It's the challenge, like it has been for this whole time, is just reaching those people that are primarily homebound. And we really want you all to know, if you know someone who is homebound, who doesn't drive, who has difficulty with transportation, we can help people get a vaccine or all three vaccines if you want them.
That's good to know. Now, Jayla, do you guys, you mentioned you provide testing for COVID. Do you set up things for people to get shots or whatever else they might need?
No, we just have the tests.
Okay, that's good to know, too.
Yeah, and we haven't gotten to that part yet. I think the health departments would be likely, the local health departments would be likely ones to do that if we needed to go that route again. But hopefully we don't ever have to go back to that again. Right.
So, John, that original vaccine that a lot of us took, what was that, number five or number six, that shot, was it last fall, early towards winter? Is that effective anymore, or we should just get ready for something new?
I think get ready for something new. I mean, I do think the incremental doses of vaccine that we've all gotten, and again, some of us got an extra booster in the spring, will have partial effectiveness even against these new variants. But if you did not get a booster in the spring, probably good, because it's now at the end of August, to wait and get the new booster.
Okay.
Which ought to be out in the next 6 weeks or so.
Right. And the other question, kind of related to this because you just touched on it, I'm already seeing on TV, like commercials, about getting the flu shots. Is the flu shot stuff out there already?
It is out there. I don't think it's too early to get the flu shot. I'd remind everybody that you can get a flu shot and a COVID shot on the same day. The RSV vaccine, at some point we may decide you can get that on the same day as well. But because it's pretty new and we don't have a lot of experience with it, that one's recommended to be given at a separate time point. And that's also in the pharmacies. I don't know about the health department, since I don't want run one anymore. I suspect they probably have it.
Yeah.
But definitely our pharmacies have got both, really all three vaccines.
And that RSV, and we're pointing our finger now at helping the older people getting the shot first. What about kids? There was a lot of cases of RSV with kids. Can they get it now, too?
It's still not approved for children, although it is approved now just recently, a new FDA decision for pregnant women. We don't ordinarily, we think of pregnant women as being really health fragile in terms of, potential health insults, and we often don't vaccinate them. But this new RSV vaccine is recommended for women in late pregnancy, specifically with the idea that if they develop a good immune response, their kids will be protected during the vulnerable period when the kid can't get their own vaccine and mount a very effective immune response. So it is a new twist, but we hope to soon, but don't yet have wide pediatric vaccines.
And I guess one other thing, Jayla, we could talk about too, and John, all those, I guess, expenses that were covered by the government for shots and stuff, that's still not in existence. So if you're getting shots now, you're paying? John?
Jayla, yeah, I'm happy to take a shot at that. Yeah, the federal government programs that paid for free testing and free treatment and free vaccines have gone away. The vaccines are now required to be provided without a copay as part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. So you can get a vaccine without having to pay a copay. But the problem is testing is going to be resource dependent. You got to pay for it. Your insurance has to pay for it. And likewise, the Paxlovid. So that's an important new twist as we enter our really fourth fall of COVID.
Right. And the flu shots, they're still available like always?
Available like always. And they're not free. They tend to be fairly inexpensive. Insurance covers them. Many pharmacies are offering them at pretty low rates. I don't know yet what the cost of the RSV vaccine is going to be. Again, it will be covered by your insurance. But if you're uninsured.
You need Medicare and Medicaid, too.
Yeah, that was my. Medicare and Medicaid would pay.
Yeah,
it's good. Yeah. Well, here we go again, unfortunately, but it's good to have you on board here, John. Jayla, thanks for bringing it to our attention again, and we'll keep people on top of things as far as what they need to be doing. And John, always good having you on No Copay Radio.
Yeah, good to be with you guys. Stay healthy and enjoy the rest of the summer.
Yeah, well, we'll do the best we can. That's Dr. John Douglas, former director of Tri-County Health, worked with the CDC. And, Jalen, we're going to take a bit of a break here on No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog. We appreciate that, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging. And we'll be right back with more.
We now continue with No Copay Radio with your hosts, Murphy Houston and Jayla Sanchez Warren.
We are back. Thank you for staying there with us. No Copay Radio, Cozy 101.1, as I said, every Sunday morning at 7:30, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging. Ever need their help? And they got a lot of help for you. 303-480-6700. I'm Murphy Houston, Jayla Sanchez Warren, who runs the Area Agency on Aging with us. Jayla, we got a new guest.
Yes, I'm excited about this, too. It's Dr. Christopher Philly. He's the founding director of Behavioral Neurology Section at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and he's a professor of neurology and psychiatry. He also serves as the senior scientific advisor for the Marcus Institute for Brain Health. Although he spent a lot of time in Alzheimer's disease, his primary interest is in behavioral neurology of white matter. He's the author or the editor of four books on behavioral neurology. Dr. Philly is considered a leading national and international expert on white matter and its disorder.
Wow, Dr. Philly. Yeah, welcome to No Copay Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, good. It's good to have you. And I guess the first question is, because I don't know about Jayla, but I know nothing and never heard of white matter.
Okay. Well, you're not alone. It's even a lot of doctors don't know much about it. But what we're talking about is a big part of the brain that's deep in the middle of it, not on the outside. So the brain's about the size of a cantaloupe in an adult. And on the outside, the rim of it is called the gray matter. It's also called the cortex. And that's what we usually think of as the part that's important for our thinking and memory and so on. And that's great. But beneath that, lower in the brain, sort of in the middle of it, below the surface, is the white matter. And it really does look white. On scans and when we see it at autopsy, because it's coated, it's an area of the brain that's very heavy in lipids and fat, which look white when you see it with the naked eye. And what that white stuff is doing is it's connecting up the gray matter of the cortex and other areas in the brain, kind of like the highways between cities or the cables between phones. It allows all the gray matter areas to communicate with each other. So it's a very important part of the brain and not well studied by neurologists and neuroscientists. So that's why I've really made it a career interest of mine.
Wow, that's pretty serious stuff there, huh, Jayla?
Yeah, well, gosh, there's so much more white matter than there is gray matter, right? And well, I never thought about this. I mean, I studied the brain in school, and that is really interesting.
It is interesting. It's about half and half, actually. Gray matter and the white matter is about evenly distributed, 50-50 each. But still, there's a lot of tissue that's not the gray matter, and it's really important. For a long time, neuroscientists and people in the field have thought, well, it's not very important. It's just the cables that connect up parts of the brain. But it really is important because many, many disorders take their root in the white matter and can really affect people's thinking, memory, and behavior in ways that are disabling. So we are very concerned about it, and I think it's an area of great promise in understanding a lot of disease states that we have trouble with right now.
That's something to think about.
Right? If one of those cables is impaired, right, then it doesn't get the right signal to the gray matter. I see a lot of behavioral, I see the manifestation of whatever's going on in the brain with behavior. And sometimes it's really hard to find services for someone who has a lot of behavior because, the folks that work with Alzheimer's, they'll say, no, it's not us. It's, or the people who work with mental illness, they'll say, oh, it's organic, so it's not us. And it's really hard sometimes to find service and help for folks that have behavioral issues, but those behavioral issues really impact their life and their ability to live successfully.
No question about it. It's a huge problem, and we're not very good at taking care of it sometimes. What I hope is that neuroscience can fill this gap because we are starting to understand more about where these problems originate, and it's often in the white matter, or at least there's a significant component of white matter disease that affects people's behavior, and we can start to address that by looking deeper in the brain than just on the outside, in the cortex. So we're very excited about this, and I really want to keep moving on it because I think it's going to help with a lot of diseases that don't have good treatments.
Well, it's a good thing you're on top of that. And I'm also glad, Dr. Philly, that you've clarified the size of the brain being a cantaloupe. All those years my brothers called me pea brain, I thought, wow, that's really an insult. Holy cow. Now I know what it really was. So thanks for clearing that up. So seriously, though, how is white matter connected to Alzheimer's disease, which is such a topic with seniors, obviously? And what you're doing sounds like a really big-time breakthrough.
Well, we certainly hope so. Part of the reason we think about this is that we have MRI scans, which can help us see early in the course of the disease or even before people are symptomatic that there are changes in the white matter that we never knew about before. So very early in the disease process, and as I say, before even symptoms, we can see changes in the white matter with these scans, which we think are part of the whole process that leads to the eventual dementia. Typically, when a doctor sees someone with Alzheimer's disease, it's late in the process, and sadly, there's not a lot that can be done, at least so far. But if we get to the early problems with the white matter disease and what that means, we could potentially treat people even before they're symptomatic at all. So we're very thrilled with that possibility. As you know, there are some drugs for Alzheimer's disease now. Recently, this new one called lecanemab. But that doesn't cure the disease. It really just slows the decline a little bit. And so it's very late in the process. We want to look at what's very early, before symptoms, and really address it then. And that's what the white matter is telling us. That's where it's directing us now, is to look at that part of the brain.
And how would you do that, though? If somebody doesn't have symptoms, why would you have any need, or how would they think you would need a need to check the white matter?
Well, it's mostly been done with these people with genetic diseases. They have mutations, and so we know they're going to get the disease later on, but they haven't got it yet. So we can look at their brains early on and see what's going on, and that's where the white matter changes are now becoming evident. We could also look at other risk factors for Alzheimer's, which are increasingly the kinds of things that are cardiovascular in origin. So hypertension, diabetes, cigarette smoking, overweight, and that sort of thing all seem to predispose to Alzheimer's disease too. So it may be that those all damage the white matter in ways that are significant before the person has clinical symptoms. So there's a lot of aspects of this that are really looking at public health that maybe we could think about preventing the disease by working on ordinary problems people have long before dementia really sets in.
That's fascinating, don't you think, Jayla? Holy cow.
Yeah. How is white matter connected to a traumatic brain injury?
That's an excellent point as well. Many people have heard of this what's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a disease that comes later in the life of football players and military combatants who've had multiple brain injuries over their lives. And that's a serious problem for which we have no cure either. And there's a lot of evidence that white matter disease contributes to that very early, that the reason people get this disease is there's damage to the white matter with every single brain injury that happens. And, you know, for a while, the brain can compensate and the person gets well and doesn't have any problems. But over time, the accumulative effect of these white matter injuries builds up, and that's what leads to the CTE, as we say. So that's another point about this. It's very important. We could potentially work on fixing the white matter injury long before it, you know, gets to the point of causing the CTE.
Yeah, I don't want to throw you a curveball here, but my dad suffers from a brain fungus and has for years and years and years. And I was wondering if you've done any work in this area. I mean, if there's any connection with brain fungus and white matter.
That's a serious problem. Fungal disease can affect all parts of the brain. It certainly doesn't spare the white matter, so sometimes it does. And then there would be all the reason to think about very vigorous treatment with antifungal drugs and that sort of treatment. It's unusual in my practice, but it does happen. And we certainly try our best to, cure that infection with the appropriate medications. It could be that, you know, the white matter disease there could be, you know, cured and lead to preventing any further problems down the road.
We're talking with Dr. Christopher Felley, who is the founding director of Behavioral Neurology Section and professor of neurology and psychiatry at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and the white matter part of the brain, which none of us has probably heard of, but boy, we're learning a lot today. And Doc, I do have a question for you. I've heard the phrase, and I've known people that have gone through chemotherapy, and they're maybe a heavier dose than others, and they get chemo brain. Is there such a thing, and does that involve the white matter we're talking about?
You know, you really nailed it. I think that's exactly what it involves. There is a chemo brain syndrome, sometimes called brain fog, in people who have had chemotherapy for their cancer. The cancer may be completely cured, which is wonderful, but the side effects linger in terms of the chemo brain in some people. And there's a good deal of evidence to support that that is damage to the white matter that causes that. These drugs are very toxic to that part of the brain, and they can lead to the loss of tissue there and persistent symptoms that go on long after the cancer is cured. So, yes, it's a real phenomenon, and I think white matter does play a role in it.
Wow, that's some real news there.
So, do you think white matter plays a role in all brain fog, like tied to fibromyalgia or tied to some of the stuff we saw from COVID, right? People getting who had COVID also talked about having this brain fog after COVID.
Yes, that happens as well. Yeah. That happens as well. I don't think we know that for sure about COVID. In fact, and there are many disorders where brain fog is part of gray matter disease as well, and it doesn't necessarily, you know, indicate that the white matter is particularly involved. So it's a very nonspecific term. But in the setting of chemo brain and others like that, there is definitely a connection with the white matter disease. So we're still learning more about this. The brain's very complicated, but I think we're making great progress by thinking about this area.
Wow, that's for sure. There could be a lot of things that have happened in your head that might be related to this. And what do you do to prevent any of that? Is there things you can do, treatments?
Well, it's largely the kind of advice that any doctor would give a person about preventing high blood pressure, watching blood sugar, blood cholesterol, staying within a normal body weight, getting exercise, getting good sleep, and I think avoiding head injuries. That's a lot to do, and of course life is complicated, and those things can still happen. But I think this public health approach, if you will, looking at all these factors that occur in people's lives and the medical issues that they can face, if we could fix all of those or at least manage them, we'd have a much better chance of living a long, healthy life without any damage to the white matter.
That would be solid. Doc, I'm curious. So somebody sitting there right now going, you know, I've had dizzy spells or something's going on they're not sure of. Could it be tied to that? Should they get that checked by, well, their physician first before more things take place?
Yes, dizzy spells definitely could mean low blood pressure, and that potentially could reduce the blood flow to the brain and particularly the white matter. So one could certainly damage the brain with persistent and severe dizzy spells. It's worth having a checkup with your primary doctor to see if there's anything that needs to be done about that.
Stuff we learned.
You just said a lot of docs don't know much about this,
right?
Right.
Dizzy spells by themselves could certainly be addressed because whatever their effects in the brain, they cause symptoms, and they usually can be fixed with the right therapy. So we hope that doctors learn more about white matter with time. That's one of my jobs. That's why I write books and papers and give talks like this. But there's still a lot of education to be done, and that's what I'm wanting to do and help people understand, and not just folks who have symptoms, but their doctors who are taking care of them.
Well, yeah. Dr. Felley, you taught us a lot today, huh, Jayla? Holy cow.
Yes, so much.
I didn't even know white matter existed. Now I feel like I could write a book after talking to Dr. Felley. Hey, Doc, thanks for coming on No Copay Radio today. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, good stuff
Thank
there,
you.
Huh, Jayla? That was great. And Jayla, have a good week. You guys, too. It's No Copay Radio every Sunday morning, 7:30 on Cozy 101.1, brought to you by our good friends at Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
This has been No Copay Radio, brought to you by Dr. Cog, the Denver Regional Council of Governments Area Agency on Aging, 303-480-6700. Join us every Sunday at 7:30 here on Cozy 101.1.